According to Robert Thurman, in the decades since the Chinese invasion of Tibet, Tibetans have seen their ecosystem destroyed, their religion, language, and culture repressed, and systematic oppression and violence against anyone who dares acknowledge Tibetan sovereignty. Yet, through all of this, the Dalai Lama has been a consistent voice for peace. Since the early 1960s, when the Dalai Lama, then 29, tutored Thurman, then 23, and mined his knowledge about Western science and culture, the two have had a special relationship. Thurman believes that by modeling peaceful resistance, the Dalai Lama shows the world that nobody is free unless everybody is free, and that solutions exist that can benefit all parties, not just one side. Robert Thurman, the first American ordained as a Tibetan monk by his friend of more than 40 years, the Dalai Lama, is professor of Indo-Tibetan Buddhist Studies at Columbia University and president of Tibet House U.S., a nonprofit dedicated to preserving and promoting Tibetan civilization. He's also the author of more than 20 books, including Inner Revolution, Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Real Happiness, Infinite Life, Awakening to Bliss Within, and his newest, Why the Dalai Lama Matters, His Act of Truth as a Solution for China, Tibet, and the World. Welcome again, Robert Thurman.
Well, thank you, Terrence. It's great to be with you on the air.
Yes. Now, we've got a bit less than 20 minutes, and one thing I want to say right off the bat, Robert, is as I researched your relationship with the Dalai Lama and this book, I thought, because of circumstances, in that I want to do this before your appearance in Santa Monica and before the Dalai Lama's appearances in L.A., I scheduled it today. But it gives us, as I said, a little less than 20 minutes, which means that I would like to schedule an hour in the future to really go into a little bit more depth.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that whenever you like.
Very good. So, given the time we've got, I want to deal with three questions. First, a brief update on the situation in Tibet, especially in light of the Dalai Lama's announcement that he's retiring from political leadership. Then in the remaining time, I'd like you primarily to share with us about your relationship with the Dalai Lama. I only learned in preparing for this interview, the two of you met in the early 60s, which if people think about it, was when we were going through civil rights struggles here, the Kennedy assassination, pre-Beatles. It was a, you know, I mean, if so people can just place it in context. And you at 23 meet the Dalai Lama at 29 and basically learn from each other. And I want to hear about that relationship. And finally, as you talk about that relationship, just give us a taste of the book, the question that you answer in the book, Why the Dalai Lama Matters. So first, what did the Dalai Lama recently do? Why did he do it? And what has been the response from Tibet and from the Chinese?
Right. Well, right now, just first about the situation in Tibet, is very bad. Because Hu Jintao is really letting the repressive forces just go all out. They just arrested 300 Tibetan monks in the east, and they're like in Kirti Monastery in the Sichuan province, which is really Tibet, the Tibet Autonomous Prefecture of there. And it's the repression is just ongoing, terrible, just like actually they're repressing their own liberals in China. So the Chinese government is acting very insecure and crazy and really breaking all attempt at showing themselves as being kind of a human rights respecting government, and it's very, very sad. Now, the Dalai Lama, in his resignation, this has been sort of a big news lately, but it isn't really new news. It's old news. He's been trying to resign for a long time in the sense that he wants to put the burden. There's been a prime minister in place, elected, directly elected prime minister in place for about 8 years already, who has made most of the decisions having to do with the politics of the Tibetan government in exile, and which the Tibetan people in Tibet look to as their sole protector and their legitimate government, by the way. They don't really consider Beijing their legitimate government, although they're forced to respect it because of by force, but otherwise they don't. And so Dalai Lama has been, as he's saying, last 8-10 years, semi-retired, which he's finding very delightful. And, of course, he's very active teaching, traveling, teaching Dharma, but and more teaching Dharma to his own Tibetans than to foreigners, but he does travel. And he is just, what this is really a formal, official resignation, ratifying the new constitution which will be the constitution for autonomous Tibet in the future, where the Dalai Lamas will not exercise any political role at all. The next Dalai Lama will not exercise any political role. He will cease to exercise any political role. And the responsibility will be on the democratic Tibetans who he'd been training for 50 years over two and a half generations to assume responsibility for their own decisions, to be peaceful with each other, not to be too divisive, to debate things, yes, but then unify around, you know, like loyal opposition ideas that you need for democracy and so on. So it's really a wonderful thing. And then it's how it influences the world political situation is, it, because he's 76 years old in a few months, it lessens the heavyweight freight on the succession issue, where China is swearing that it was going to appoint the next Dalai Lama, and if the Communist Party could appoint reincarnations, which they don't believe in, which is the funniest thing.
Yes.
It started that with the Panchen Lama in the past, like about 10, 15 years ago.
I remember that, yes.
It created a stupid disaster. They're arresting the legitimate Panchen Lama and putting up some puppet, a child of some communist officials, and totally not respected or accepted by the Tibetan people, by the way, so losing any role of being a puppet. But anyway, but there's something to show it outside. So this, but anyway, because the Dalai Lama will not have political power of any kind, then there's less of a fuss about it, and it will be, he will be religiously replaced if he did pass. But actually, we, of course, don't expect him to pass until after finally some Chinese government, some version of a Chinese government, has come to its senses and has realized that someone who everyone else on the planet is a friend of is a friendly person. And they could benefit by being friends to him themselves. And this is this thing about he's the evil this and that, and we have to crush the Tibetans and that they've been doing, and we have to try to replace the Tibetans because they're not Chinese, so therefore they'll never let us really own their land legitimately unless we get rid of them, which is the source of the genocide, of course. And so, they, but that's a default policy. The Chinese people who grow up at sea level or nearer there cannot live at 2.5 or 3 miles altitude without getting heart disease and miscarrying babies, and they simply cannot live. If they could live on the Tibetan High Plateau, they would have been there in the hundreds of millions at least 100 or 200 or 300 years ago without any Communist Party. But the reason they're not up there, and Tibet only has 6 million people, is that a very special type of physiology can last and thrive at that altitude. They have a unique blood chemistry that even the Bolivians don't have. And so the Chinese should just be realistic and bag it, you know.
That's right. So in other words, in this one, they're confounding their beliefs about religion and they're fighting Mother Nature. It just compounds itself.
And it's very damaging to themselves and to all the other countries in Asia. Because Tibet is the watershed, it's the giant water tower of all of Asia. And, you know, the Ganges, the Indus, the Brahmaputra, the Salween, the Mekong, the Yellow River, the Yangtze River, all of them rise in Tibet. And they depend in the dry seasons, non-monsoon seasons, on the melting glaciers. And by cutting the forests as vastly as the Chinese have done, and by desertifying the steppe, as they have done by trying to do commercial animal husbandry on that Tibet rather than the type that the Tibetans did with the nomadic yaks. You know, the Chinese have been fencing and putting in the wrong kind of animals who bite the grass out of the fragile soil.
Right.
And so they've been ruining the ecology of the plateau. It's been warming much faster than any global warming would have it warming. And they're melting the glaciers too fast. Their own Yellow River is more or less out of water 300 or 400 miles before the Yellow Sea. The Yangtze is in trouble. The Mekong is in trouble. The Indian rivers have not yet shown trouble, but they've been having some glacial lake floods and some disasters in Bhutan and other places. And it's very, very dangerous for the whole ecology of Asia, all the watersheds and the river systems of Asia. It's very, very bad. So they will come to their senses inevitably very soon. And this will change, and we do hope the next government that comes in 2012 will make the change. We've sort of given up on Hu Jintao. I wrote the book I wrote to give Hu Jintao a chance to get himself a Nobel Peace Prize.
Exactly.
Becoming sensible about the Dalai Lama and having a win-win solution where China wins by being humane and intelligent about Tibet rather than loses. They would totally win, and I showed that in a very irrefutable campaign and program of how they could do that. But they've chosen to ignore that and continue to demonize the Dalai Lama and continue to genocide the Tibetan people. It's very, very sad.
But that idea of a 29-year-old Dalai Lama and a 23-year-old Robert Thurman meeting in probably 63 or 64, What was that? And then, you know, in the few minutes we have left, a little the evolution of that relationship.
Yes, well, it was really quite marvelous. I left Harvard in 61, in the fall of 61, in order to seek enlightenment in Asia, you know, like Hermann Hesse, Journey to the East, you know, and Siddhartha and all this kind of thing, and Gurdjieff, all these, and Buddhist texts, you know, and looking for a guru. And I saw many Eastern Orthodox holy saints and many Sufi saints and many Hindu Swami saints. But somehow none of them held me more than a month or two. And I finally got to India and I met the Tibetans, and somehow that was my karma. And Buddha Dharma is coming from India, but through the Tibetan cultures, where they preserve Indian Buddhism so well, was really like, it was salvation to me. It was just wonderful. But not as a matter of something to believe in, but as a matter of something to study and learn from and meditate on and develop real change in my mind and heart that gave me great relief. And in the process of that, I soon met His Holiness Dalai Lama, because my own guru, my original guru, an old Mongolian gentleman who knew a lot about the West, who'd been out in the West for a long time, he knew that I would not find the support, the social support I needed as an American, as a New Yorker, to remain a monk for life. I lived like a monk already for a couple of years, and I was determined to be an official monk with a red robe and a shaved head and the whole thing. And my old lama said, my old guru said, don't do that, you can't. But, well, when I kept insisting and insisting, he said, well, I'll take you to Dalai Lama, and maybe he will make you a monk. Yeah, and then when he introduced me to Dalai Lama, he said, this is a good boy, very intelligent, very devoted, and he sincerely wants to be a monk for life, but he will not be able to be a monk for life. The circumstances will not allow it, so I don't recommend it, but it's up to you to judge. Who am I? I'm just an old Mongolian Lama. You're the Dalai Lama. So then Dalai Lama examined me extensively for a year, and actually we ended up talking about every other thing than Buddhism as well, because I was the second person in his life who had spoken fluent Tibetan, you know, Western person who had spoken fluent Tibetan, which I already spoke. And so we talked about Freud and Jefferson and Ben Franklin and sociology and physics and history and geography and what have you, you know, and we had a great time. And I just got to love him a lot, and vice versa. We became really good friends. And he referred me to his senior teachers to study with him, so I was kind of a classmate of his, almost, you could say, in the studies. You know, because people don't realize that Tibetan Buddhism, Indo-Tibetan Buddhism, is very much a process of study and learning, as well as there's meditation and being pious and holy. And then finally, because I pestered him so much, in spite of the warning of the old monk, he agreed to make me a monk, and he ordained me. And I did become one, and lasted for about a year until I had to go back to the States, you know, for visa issues and various things, being an American. And then in the States, as my old Mongolian Lama had predicted, I couldn't last because there was no monastery, no real place for me to live. There was no social support. My friends thought I'd gone nuts. And my mother thought I was crazy, although, you know, they respected me, they were nice to me, but it just wasn't possible. So then I resigned the robe, which disappointed His Holiness very much. And and eventually then became a professor, which then made him happy. And it, as it turned out, he kind of liked my wife and my children better than me. So it all worked out in the long run. You know, he thought they were more interesting even than I was. And I got, you know, and I didn't, and I was happy with that. I was pleased with that. And we've remained very good friends. And during that first year, which is what you want to focus on, it was really fascinating. I had to make up new words to talk about Freud's concepts and Jung and Wilhelm Reich, who was a friend of mine, and Wittgenstein and Einstein and Heisenberg and quantum physics and so on. And although I wasn't a science major, so I didn't satisfy him on some of my explanations, maybe about science, more because I was more literary humanities sort of philosophy guy. And later he talked with other people on sciences and got a lot out of that. But he was already, like he's become famous for since, very fascinated by science. And not because it was a quirk of his, but because Buddhism is scientific as well as religious. And people don't realize if it's one-third science, maybe one-third or one-sixth religion, and it is and psychology, one-third, and one-third ethics, actually, social ethics Buddhism is, and it's very, very broad civilizational thing, not just a narrow religious faith. And so he was just doing what Buddhists naturally do, which is show great curiosity about the nature of reality, and he had some guy from Harvard and Phillips Exeter and so on who could explain a number of things, although, as I say, I wasn't a physics major, so maybe I wasn't as good on those topics in those days as I might have been later, and as a professional scientist would be. But anyway, we had a good time, and we really got to be friendly, and I really admire him.
Now, let me ask one...
I encouraged him even then to resign from politics, saying that it was, you know, what, so what, never mind, just do the Dharma and then be a worldwide guru and everything, because I could see he could be that, because he was so deep and so profound, and he was so much practicing what he preached totally himself all the time, as he has done ever since. Absolutely, I've watched his growth and development over almost 50 years now, and he really, really practices what he preaches, and he's really become one of the greatest, maybe the greatest Dalai Lama ever, actually, I think, and fascinating, kind of Dalai Lama to the world. And when I give a talk in Santa Monica, I'm going to talk a lot more about why I said in that book that his act of truth, which is an Indian concept, where even a weak person, if they really cling to the truth, they can make the Ganges flow backward. You know, the world will come around to that if they keep at it. And his act of truth is a huge solution for the world, because in this world, we really need the lesson of a culture and a nation that has managed to demilitarize over centuries in history and become nonviolent. Our great danger nowadays, really, one of our really great dangers. And so by showing that you could solve this problem between China and Tibet nonviolently, which eventually will be solved that way, this sets the example for all of these issues and problems in the world to be solved without war. You know.
The book is Why the Dalai Lamas. The web, Why the Dalai Lama Matters. The website is bobthurman.com. Bob, T-H-U-R-M-A-N.com. Thank you, Robert Thurman. We'll do this again soon. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Terrence. All the best.